So once again, I'm not Art Jolly. I don't know what I'm just planning on talking about. And I was busy all day, so I really didn't have a chance to think of much to say. So we're going to do a discussion tonight. I'm going to, and don't groan. What we found in the past is people always go discuss, and I'm the same way. Discussion, oh no, I don't want to talk to people. I just want to listen to the entertainment. And then once we actually do it, we enjoy it. And this is a chance for people to actually talk to each other in the Sangha. Sangha is really important to us all. And many of us are here for Sangha, and yet, ironically, here we are coming to gather together in Sangha, and then we shut up. We're quiet for 2 hours. We don't say anything. We're in silence. You know, we try to work around it a little bit. We hang out a little bit afterwards. We do social Sunday once a month. But it's nice occasionally just to hang out with your Sangha mates. So, but I want to set a question, which you may find interesting, you may not. And I'm going to start by talking about Nagarjuna. So you may not know who Nagarjuna is. I didn't. Stephen Batchelor says that Nagarjuna was the first or the earliest of the great Buddhist thinkers after the Buddha himself. We don't know a whole lot about him. He lived around the 1st and 2nd century AD. And in fact, that's only a rather good guess by scholars. And when I look at what the guess is based on, it's pretty shaky, but it's frankly the best guess we've got. We don't know a lot about him. There's a lot of mythologizing about him. There are a lot of manuscripts about him. But they're along the lines of, here's a for instance, Nagarjuna got his teachings by actually diving to the bottom of a deep lake, defeating a sea serpent. Okay, I guess it's a lake serpent, technically. But defeating the large freshwater sea serpent and retrieving a chest in which the Buddha had hidden manuscripts, because the manuscripts were like too dangerous, or people were just not ready for these deep teachings yet. So the Buddha had to lock them up in a chest and put them down under a guardian, sort of a formidable beast. By the way, this is a theme that keeps on coming up century after century. People keep on discovering things that the Buddha wrote and hid away, written in all kinds of languages that he didn't speak. Chinese, Tibetan, various other languages, Indian and Southeast Asian. And they were still finding them as late as the 19th century. So, you know, it would lead you to believe that the Buddha spent all of his time or had like just a huge number of scribes, because there are literally truckloads, trainloads of this material. Now, the Nagarjuna stuff is actually pretty good stuff. There are a number of works attributed to him, but there's only one that scholars pretty much agree he actually did write. And it's titled, the translation is something like Fundamental Verses or Foundational Stanzas. And the best translation, in fact, the only translation that I know about, is a translation from Tibetan by Stephen Batchelor. And the title is Verses from the Center. And it's really good. I really recommend it. It's very readable. So Nagarjuna was Indian. He was teaching in response, I think, to the fact that Buddhism at the time had become a growing, rigid orthodoxy, as organized religions tend to become. And there were a number of things that he felt were antithetical to the teachings of the Buddha. And I think he was right. Among other things, there was a strong belief, you know, the Buddha himself taught that fundamentally, nothing really has an independent existence. Nothing is sort of solid and independent. Everything exists through an interdependence, a radical contingency. And I think he makes this pretty clear, the Buddha does. He certainly makes it clear with regards to the self that you can't point to any solid thing that is a self. He certainly rejected the idea of there being an Atman or oversoul or any particular soul that you could point to and say, this is the self. And it's pretty clear, I think, that he also meant that to apply to all objects. But a lot of people, by Nagarjuna's time, looked at particularly teachings found in the Abhidhamma, which is called the Buddhist psychology. And in the Abhidhamma, there are things like there are 17 mind instances in every mind moment, in every mind event, right? And they're mapped out what those 17 are. Not all of them light up, by the way, for every mental event. I mean, there's this very elaborate thing going on. I can't possibly do it justice. It's actually quite interesting. But it is believed that this is real truth, that this is actual fundamental truth. I think Nagarjuna rejected the idea that this was any more truthy than anything else in our perception, in our world. So this is sort of the stage for Nagarjuna. So why am I talking about Nagarjuna so much? Nagarjuna said something really interesting that has really bugged me for a long time. He is he is also considered to be the father, the founder of Mahayana Buddhism. And he is the founder of Madhyamaka Buddhism, which actually did morph to Mahayana Buddhism, the Buddhism that's practiced by most of the Buddhist world, in China particularly. And interestingly, Nagarjuna, what we often think of as the defining characteristic of Mahayana as opposed to Theravada Buddhism, our lineage, is the idea of the bodhisattva, the ideal of the bodhisattva. That is, why be selfish and become enlightened when there are all these suffering people out there? Wouldn't it be better if you stuck around lifetime after lifetime and used the merit that you were developing, used the powers that you were developing as a meditator, as a practitioner, to help other people become enlightened. You know, let's get everybody enlightened, which is a wonderful thought. It's a great ideal. Nagarjuna didn't say anything about that. It's an idea that comes later in Mahayana. What's interesting about Nagarjuna, what's striking about him that people talk about, particularly about Nagarjuna, is the idea of emptiness. The Pali word is shunyata. And of course, the Buddha talked about shunyata. I mean, it wasn't a novel idea, but I think it had become sort of forgotten by Nagarjuna's time, and he really returned to the idea of shunyata, of emptiness. And what does that mean? Well, I don't know. I'm not sure. His famous statement that I alluded to is, form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. No, wait, it's emptiness is form, and form is emptiness. Or no, it's the first one. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. I'm sure it's important. No, I'm kidding. I'm not sure it's important. So form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. And so I've puzzled over that one a lot. Sometimes I'll wake up in the middle of the night and go, oh yeah, I got it. And then, you know, in the morning I go, yeah, that doesn't really hold together. Or sometimes I really think I've got the form is emptiness part. Yeah, okay, I get that. But emptiness is form? Yeah, that doesn't make sense. So what I wanted to do tonight is open up for discussion in small groups. And the question is, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Does this have meaning for me? And whether or not it does, is this a silly question? Are we getting into some kind of philosophical hair splitting here, sort of an angel's dancing on the head of the pin? Or is it something that I can use in my own practice or in my own worldview? Is this something that could inform my approach to things? Could it be the focus of a meditation? Is Bill just full of crap up there asking us to do this? That's a legitimate answer, by the way. So what I'd like to do is break up into groups a little bigger than usual of four. Four is a good number. Five, if we get, you know, an odd number, but let's look for four. And I would also like to encourage people not to group up with people that they came with, just so that we get a little bit of a randomization effect. So I'll ring a bell in some amount of time, and we'll get together and see what we've come up with, if anything. So please take a moment and thank your fellow discussers. Take a few moments to come back to order. So I heard a lot of interesting fragments of ideas. I didn't go and snoop, eavesdrop on any particular group. Oh, but one group asked me to adjudicate particular. I declined. So I want to hear some of the ideas that came up. And Corey, could you be the microphone help? Anyone?
We each use different words, but I think what we kind of got to was that emptiness is something that we put onto an object. And that's also what we put on as a form. We give it a form that it doesn't natively, inherently have.
What's the it?
What?
What is the it?
Good question. That is a different question.
Right. Well, it's very interesting because it seems that it's very much about not inherent in the objects themselves, but in our perception. Other observations? Come on, I heard a lot of interesting ideas bubbling up. They didn't all just evaporate, or did they become empty?
Well, we started talking about
wait for the mic.
We started talking about dance. It's either not on or I'm sure you got it. We started talking about a dance and talked about how form and emptiness depend on each other. And then we ended by talking about creativity, how the two work together, the formless realm and the forming realm, to create objects of art and other activities in human life that are loving and positive.
Interesting. Okay, over here.
The words that you put forth for us to reflect upon, to me, implied a certain amount of impermanence. And so that's what came to me thinking about all of this, is how emptiness forms emptiness. It was hard to, as others said in the group as well, it was hard to just grasp onto the words and really understand it just by the phraseology, but if you can let go of the words, what came from it was that it seemed to imply the formless as being impermanent, as things passing. That a lot of that was what I was thinking about initially. Other things came from that, but that was one of the ideas.
I think Jan over here wanted to say something.
Yeah, thank you. To add on, I think maybe what Zoe said, but maybe not, a different group was form being redefined as structure, organization, labeling, identity, and names. So we worked, that was for me. That wasn't so what the group did, but that was I needed a way to work with form as a word and emptiness. Emptiness would be without. all that.
Right. There was sort of a gotcha element to this, and that was I did not try to define form or emptiness. I'm not sure I could. Someone else?
Just from my own piece in that, is that I have found that I can experience it in meditation, but I can't intellectually. I get down, kind of a rabbit hole intellectually. I get really just kind of crazy in my mind. but it's very obvious in meditation.
I like that. Lucia, back there.
First of all, this is my own personal conclusion. I don't think there is any such a thing as emptiness. And form, or function follows form, and that goes back to Design 101 when I was in college. So. But I don't believe there is such a thing as emptiness. Because even if it's impermanent, when something changes, it changes into some other form, maybe. And an emptiness means a total absence of anything. And I don't know that we can say that we can be totally absent of everything and anything. So that's my conclusion about the question. And I'm just going to leave it at that. I'll think about it. If I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'll give you a call.
That's interesting. Well, I turn off my cell phone at night. That's a very interesting viewpoint. It does depend on a certain definition of emptiness, which someone else might not agree with. But Alice?
I think you're right, but I think that Gil Fronsdale doesn't. He uses emptying and emptiness, and so he uses it like a progression to thin out the self.
So we started about trying to figure out emptiness, and we took the example of the bell. How the bell defines a certain emptiness. And sort of went from there down some strange paths of not self, and ended up on that concept. It wasn't an intellectual concept of empty emotions, but a felt sense of empty emotions that we really kind of ran out of time to define.
I wasn't sure whether to let it go longer or.
When I think about emptiness, I think about form. Our group, it reminds me of watching a show that was explaining Einstein's theories. And it's like you, Mary. I could grok it. I could hold it in my head. But it was not a thought with words. It was more a very right brain gestalt kind of concept. And to me, it's the form and the emptiness. They each depend upon each other. And so for me, I could, it's like a dance. And I really am reluctant to put, I think every time you start to define something, it's like describing myself. Every time someone describes who I am, I feel like I'm getting smaller and smaller and smaller because I have to fit into all those boxes and all those labels. And to me, it's something that's really without labels. So, and it's something to sit with in kind of my I don't know mind, and not to try and form words or cognate about. But it's more of that felt sense of what it feels like to me. And it definitely is something I might feel when I'm in that foul state when I'm not up in the coconut.
Right. I have to say, when I think about the phrase, form is emptiness, and emptiness is form, I get goosebumps. even though I don't necessarily understand it, it does give me the willies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Stephen Batchelor once said, if shunyata doesn't frighten you, then you don't understand it. And he says, and I don't know if I agree with him, that the Buddha used the word deliberately to shock people.
Which word?
Shunyata, what we translate as emptiness. And that's, you know, I think Batchelor says that it actually is a good translation. I'm not an expert, so I couldn't say. Anyone else? Corey?
Yeah. We didn't talk about this in the group, but one of the other, any kind of dialogue around this type of stuff is often that old thing about pointing at the moon, it's not the moon, and you kind of really have to sit with it and, you know, examine it. But one of the things that helps point me toward the moon is just the idea of empty space in art. And Barbara was talking about this a little bit, just that idea of the space between the notes is more important than the notes often in creating the music and the feeling and the response that you get, or whether it's in poetry or whether it's visual art, in that empty space again. And that really does create that response that you have as a viewer or listener of art.
That's a good point. The big thing about music is knowing when not to play. Right. Right. Someone else.
So I think we were kind of literal, maybe. Anyway, so first of all, I just thought about that state of what being resting in awareness, and how our meditation can sometimes allow this spaciousness. Now, whether or not that's emptiness, and there's a lot of space there. If it's 100% empty, I don't know, but like the protons and the neurons and the electrons, and that we're just really all connected in that way. And to me, that's kind of, well, emptiness or interconnectedness. And then we talked a little bit about the form being actually maybe the process of getting to that point. But then it went on to evolve into also even identity and like the whole transgender and identity now, and that Corey and I were hearing this program on supposedly the first woman gondola person. But it turns out that she's in a female body, but she's always identified as male. And so she just didn't even want to go along with that whole thing about first woman gondola, because she never identified as a female. Anyway, so we just, all those things about how we see something, we see a form, and we have sometimes assumptions, but that maybe that person's empty of those assumptions, you know.
And that goes back to it being a matter of our awareness or our perception rather than something inherent in what it is that we're looking at. Anyone else? We might get to go home early. All right, Barbara?
Well, no one else mentioned it. Philip talks about the stillness, and we talked about that, and we talked about that in our group, and that forms and sound arise out of the stillness. And I thought in that sense of silence and meditating, and awareness and stillness and emptiness tend to overlap as concepts. Again, they're only just concepts, but they're pointing at something. It's not just nothing.
Mm-hmm.
That's nice. Or maybe just, I don't know.
Everything.
Well, there's a lot of interesting ideas here. And be nice to sort of get written reports from everybody, but I don't feel like assigning homework. I do have to say that when I read this morning, I did manage to take time to look up Nagarjuna in Wikipedia. Didn't learn a whole lot, but what was interesting is that they did cite this statement of his, and their explanation wasn't terribly helpful either. And in fact, if you look in other places, you will find other explanations. So I don't think anybody is in complete agreement with what it means. The Wikipedia entry did some arm waving about dependent origination, the notion that nothing really has an independent existence, that everything is really a set of interlocking functions, of processes that are continuing to go on. Some of them look very stable because their processes are very long compared to those of a human life. And human life is much longer than, say, the process around a mayfly or an eddy in a creek. So I don't know if that's helpful. To me, I like the idea of thinking of it as experiential, or thinking of it as something about our perception of the world rather than something inherent in the world. And the Buddha was, and it's worth mentioning, what's striking about the Buddha was that he was very epistemological in his teaching, whereas everybody else is ontological. And let me explain those, because those are great words. You can use them on your friends and impress people on the bus. Ontological statement is a statement about truth, an absolute truth. Saying that people are reborn in new bodies is an ontological assertion. Saying that the universe started with a big bang is an ontological assertion. You know, it could be true, it could be false, it could be unverifiable, but it's ontological in the sense of you're saying this is truth with a capital T. Epistemology is about our perception. It's about what we can know and how we can know it. And the Buddha really focused on what we can know and how we can know it, and he discouraged people from talking about what's true and what's not true. You get this over and over again in the suttas. He'd slap around his followers and say, forget that stuff. You need to be practicing. You need to be dealing with the fundamental issue of suffering and the ending of suffering. But I like, because I'm curious, I'm curious about emptiness and form and emptiness. But I find it's more helpful to think of it as being about what we can know, what we can't know, how we can know things, rather than stating something as being an absolute truth. And I think that was what Nagarjuna was getting at too, because people were getting into reifying certain parts of Buddhist teachings that had become ossified, that had become rigorous and rigid, and had formed around certain parts of what were regarded as the Buddhist teachings. And Nagarjuna rejected that and was really sort of a back-to-the-fundamentals kind of guy. And what he was saying was, I think, pretty much what the Buddha was saying, that it's not about anything that you can assert as a truth with a capital T, that it's all about what you can know, how you can know it, what your perception is, what is the nature of awareness. Deborah?
So I'm just wondering if everybody's take here tonight is exactly an example of forms of emptiness. When I started at Dharma, I was a green belt for several years, and we used to chant the Heart Sutra. Thank you. We used to chant the Heart Sutra at the end of every Sunday morning service, and that phrase is in the Heart Sutra, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. It took me many years to even have any kind of opinion about what that means. But I'm sort of smiling because I think listening, I'm smiling because it occurs to me that everybody has a facet of what that is when we're giving our explanations of what we discussed in our different groups. I hope that sentence made sense. And I personally always thought of emptiness as sort of potential, and form as causes and conditions come together. And, you know, we talked about a lot of what we're hearing and what you're saying. What can we know and how can we know it, and concepts and projection. And interrelationship and impermanence. We talked about that. We talked about how much space is between the molecules, the bits and pieces that make up this chair that we think of as solid. We talked about it being a green, it's a very squeaky chair. We talked about it being an agreement among all of us to navigate the relative reality that we live in, that this is chair. And also what Mary Page said about in meditation, I can experience my body dissolving. And I don't know where, you know, if my hand is touching my other hand, where one starts and where one stops. But how do you, I don't even want to conceptualize too much about that. I don't think I have any more to say. Hope somebody else has. Thank you.
Well, it covers a fair bit of ground there. But yeah, I think as a meditational experience, when you notice things are radically impermanent, which can be quite frightening, frankly, at first. Because you start by seeing everything's dissolving really rapidly, but you may not notice that also other things are coming into being just as rapidly. So if you just see things dissolving, it can get kind of freaky. But I don't want to go too much further into that, but leave it as an open question for you and for your practice, if you find it useful. So I think we're ready for meta cards.